You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
And welcome everyone to another episode of the Mythgreens Podcast. I'm Oren, with me today is
Wes
and
Chris.
And this week, I will be separating the opening bit into six parts. You'll have to tune in next week, and then 5 weeks after that to get the rest. Am I not very clever? Now you have to buy six podcasts. By buy, I mean download for free on the internet.
But hey, maybe each podcast is really satisfying in itself.
It might be. Who knows? My evidence suggests otherwise, though. Today we are talking about episodic prose stories, and there are basically two versions of that. There is a single novel with an episodic structure, and then a series of shorter connected stories. And we can talk about both. It's all right with you two. I would like to start off talking about the first one, the single novel with an episodic structure.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Because I can only think of one book that did this well, and it's Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the third Narnia book. And, like, you know, Narnia is fine as book series go. It has a lot of problems, especially towards the end. But it's certainly not what I would consider, like, a brilliant series or, like, foundational to anything in particular. And yet, for some reason, Dawn Treader is the only book I can find that I feel like does this internal episodic structure with any success.
Well, there's also The Silver Chair. And that's not saying a lot because it is also a Narnia book and is the one right after the Dawn Treader. But The Silver Chair, I think, also does it quite well.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I hadn't really thought about The Silver Chair, but yeah.
But, I mean, that doesn't really broaden the pool very much because they're both Narnia books.
I don't know, maybe just because this type of story, like, maybe was losing steam, like, when, you know, the Victorians started giving us, like, the novel. And, I mean, you know, Dickens, he definitely, like, released his stuff over time as well, but it wasn't the same type of thing. It certainly isn't, like, Gulliver's Travels, which is, you know, Gulliver having a series of different adventures in different places, and which is similar to Dawn Treader going to different islands and things like that. But I don't know, maybe it just was never as popular or as good, honestly.
Well, we tried to read Gulliver's Travels and we just got really bored.
It is boring. I mean, at the time, I'm sure it was fascinating, but, like, you know, we have really good imaginations now.
To today's audience, it's just much too slow and nothing happens.
Right. Also, I think that Gulliver's Travels was originally designed as a work of satire, and so it would probably have landed better with the people who knew the things it was satirizing, would be my guess.
I do think that many of the works that we know of do fit this format. Some of them have problems, but it's not always because of the episodic format. Another book that I think is episodic is The Hobbit. And The Hobbit has its problems, right? I mean, one of the biggest problems in The Hobbit is that, like, Gandalf is too powerful. So he'll, like, hang out with them, and then whenever there needs to be conflict, he'll, like, disappear. And then they'll get in trouble, and then he'll come back and just rescue them again. And, you know, it has its issues, but it's not because of the episodic format.
I think I should probably lay out the criteria for what I think a book needs to have in order for this to actually work, and then I can explain why so many other books don't do it. So your standard model of a plot is you have a single through line, and that's what you're working on for the entire story. And, you know, you start with the problem as close to the beginning as you can, and it's the same problem all the way through, and then you resolve it at the end. And that's sort of your standard storyline. But the episodic variant has a series of connected but still fairly separate episodes or problems, you know, within the same story. And that seems to be a real challenge. And I think there are a few reasons why, and I think that one of them is simply that people don't know that if you're going to do this, you still want an overarching plot of some kind. Otherwise, it's like, why are these being published in the same book? But you need to have the right kind. I've actually encountered a number of stories, especially client stories, that want to do this kind of episodic storytelling, but then they put some kind of overarching goal with a time limit. And it's like, wait, hang on. No, if it's got a time limit now, like, everything has to be about going and getting that thing. Because it's like, we don't have time to mess around here, man. The time limit's going to run out.
Yeah, this isn't an open world role-playing game.
So the way that I would define what it makes it episodic, that kind of clarifies this a little bit, is the relative tension between the through line and the child arcs. Okay, so in a normal novel, usually the through line, the big arc that is the problem addressed throughout the whole story, is providing the most tension. It has the highest stakes. And there's child arcs, and they're important to the through line, but they aren't substantially more tense than the through line itself. And the through line, again, that has a ticking clock. That's normally a great thing. But in an episodic story, the through line has a lower tension, usually because it has less urgency. It still needs to be important to the main character. And all the characters who are, you know, if it's a travel story, which a lot of these episodic stories are, they don't have to be travel stories, but traveling is a pretty typical. So they need reasons, important reasons to them to be on this journey. But it's not usually urgent, and therefore the tension is lower, which means that it's the child arcs of the problems that they encounter on their way to doing this through a line that are front and center because they have the most tension. So if you look at Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, they're similar in a lot of ways, but Lord of the Rings has a higher tension through line than The Hobbit does, and so it's not really an episodic story.
Right. Like, they do travel in Lord of the Rings, but the things that they do as they travel are only important in so much as they affect the journey to get the ring to Mordor. Whereas in episodic stories, those things are often important for their own reasons. I think one place that a lot of authors trip up is that individual episodes need to have their own three essential elements for a story, which is like a problem, a turning point, and a resolution. And I found that a lot of stories that look like they're trying to do this episodic format are really just kind of meandering. Long Way to a Small Angry Planet is like that, where it looks like it's supposed to be episodic. We have, like, an overarching problem that we're told is, you know, not urgent, even though it seems like it should be, because it's a really important government job. But, you know, whatever. We're told they don't really have a time limit. And so that seems like that would be a natural fit for episodic storytelling, but, like, the places they go don't have a problem or a turning point or a resolution most of the time. It's like, well, here, we stopped at these guys' place and we hung out with them for a while and talked. And then we went to this place and did some stuff. And then we went here and did some more stuff, right? There's a lot of the storylines have those issues, which is why the story can feel kind of boring.
It's just that they wanted to have scenes, not really episodes. Like, oh, I'll set a scene over here and that'll be new and novel and great. And you're like, okay, why?
Well, you'll just want to see this character interact with, like, their friends. And it's like, you know, if I really like that character, maybe, but imagine you could have that and also have a problem, a resolution, and a turning point and a resolution, which would make me be interested in, even if I don't love that character enough to just want to watch them talk to their friends. Another thing that I would say that these stories need is that the episodes need to build on each other to a certain extent. If it starts to feel like you could just take out certain episodes and the rest of the story would be the same, that's a problem. And that's actually the problem I would say the novel Lovecraft Country has. Because Lovecraft Country actually does have, each episode has its own, you know, problem, turning point, resolution. It's just that they're so disparate that, like, half of them you don't even need to read to understand the main plot.
That's true. You could, and, you know, it's kind of funny watching the show, I've only done a few episodes, how they've decided to keep the main character of the first story, Atticus. They really want him to just be the main character in the show.
That is the correct choice.
Which is, like, fine. But then in the books, I was, by the way, taken back when I opened it up. I read the first story in this episodic novel that was called Lovecraft Country. And then I turned the page and there was a brand new title. And I was like, I thought I was reading Lovecraft Country. But you're right. The first story, like, introduced, like, the main characters that were there in the last story. But you could just read the first and last story and would be like, okay, Like, I get it. Like, you know, I know why they did what they did at the end. Some of the means that they got to achieve what they did at the end was possible because of a few of the stories. But you're right. It's like you run into a problem. It's like an interlude. Here we are, like, watching people eat popcorn or doing other things that interludes do, scare quotes.
Did the chapter where that lady went to the haunted house ever have an impact on the ending? I can't remember. Like, in the novel, I cannot remember if that actually had any kind of impact.
I think that they made that the second episode of the TV show. They call it Dreams in the Witch House, but like W-H-I-C-H. And the point of that story is that Letitia gets a bunch of money that she thinks is an inheritance from her mother, and she buys a house in a white neighborhood. And this house is super haunted by an old ghost. And in the book, I won't speak to the show, because I liked how the book did it better. The turning point, well, basically the conflict happens is that the house is trying to kill her. And the turning point, it basically ends up to being this like kind of battle of wills that she wins and begrudgingly earns the ghost's respect. In another story, well, we learn the name of that ghost who used to be associated with this Titus Braithwaite, and they were rivals. And so we kind of learn that her getting that ghost on their side was important in what they did at the end of the book.
Okay, right. That's what it was. Yeah, I remember the book kind of, it felt like it was kind of stretching.
Yeah, it did stretch.
Okay, see, there was this thing that happened in that otherwise unrelated story, and it's important now at the end, and it's like, okay, I guess that's better than nothing.
It's tough because, I mean, like, I enjoyed quite a lot of the characters in that book, but I don't think a lot of them really need, certainly a few of them didn't need, like, their own real stories, which puts a strain on your resources as a reader, you know? So it's easy to, like, miss those things. I had to go back and check. Like, that was why. I was like, what? How did they know how to do this? Oh, they befriended a ghost.
Like, I really liked the main character in the first story. I was not happy to suddenly be not reading about him. You hooked me with that character. Why are you changing it to be a different character and starting over from scratch?
There was one story that in there in the middle, and the main characters of that story were Atticus's uncle and dad. And for whatever reason, they had to break into a vault in a museum to steal this, like, you know, magically guarded, like, book or something like that. And Atticus is with them. I had to reread it. Atticus is with them through the whole thing and really doesn't do anything. I'm just like, but you were great in the first story. Like, I mean, you just, like, took charge and you have, like, a military background and you're confident and you know what to do. And I guess, like, you just don't want to, like, upstage your uncle and your dad.
He was around.
Yeah. So don't do that. Danger.
Well, when it comes to looking at how these episodes fit into the through line, I do think, for one thing, they really should feel like child arcs of a through line, right? They should feel like steps in that through line. With a lot of travel stories, I think it's a little more intuitive to have episodes that are important waypoints along the journey. I think it probably gets a lot more tricky if you're not doing a travel story, because then you have to come up with another framework for why all of these events have to happen in sequence for the story to work. I do think it's worth looking, going back to Voyage of the Dawn Treader and the Silver Chair. Admittedly, Voyage of the Dawn Treader is pretty loose with this. It does, again, the islands that it stops at are all stops along the way. The other thing it does is they're on a quest to find these lords that went off and disappeared. And so periodically at their islands, they will usually find a clue. They'll either find one of the lords or they'll find, you know, actually most islands, I think they find at least one, a dead lord, sometimes a living lord. So they kind of like pick them up along the way. But frankly, that in that story, it wouldn't be too hard to just extract one of those islands and move one of those lords to a different island or something like that. But in the Silver Chair, most of the episodes are a lot more instrumental to how the characters find their way. Like, they first stop and see, they go to the palace of Narnia and they learn about the problems that are happening, right? That's clearly, like, inextractable. And then they go other places that gives them a clue that tells them where they need to go next. It's not intuitive. Like, oh, here we have to actually go underground. We see this big message that gives us a hint, and now we go underground. And there's just no way that would have happened without that kind of important episode that's built around that. So in Silver Chair, it's similar in some ways, but definitely the episodes are less extractable than in Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Don Treader also does like a certain amount of character development as the goal of various child arcs. Like sometimes when they stop at an island, it's to like learn something about themselves or whatever, for better or worse. Sometimes it's the things they learn are good, sometimes not so much.
Yeah. One thing that I think Voyager the Dawn Treader does well that somebody doing an episodic story should also keep in mind is how do you escalate the story? Because you do still want it to have an escalation as it gets towards the climax. And there's different ways to do that. In Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it's the sense that they're getting farther and farther away from home into weirder and weirder lands. So it has a sense of something building. They're building towards getting to like the edge of the world. It also has increasing novelty as the places that they go get stranger, right? Which is a little more unusual. Most stories would build a lot more tension as it goes, and Dawn Treader doesn't so much, but it has increasing novelty. It's like towards the end when you get to like look through the water and see all those mer people hanging out. There's some wonderful description in that book. But oftentimes in other books, you would have increasing tension, or I think it's totally viable to have the story be more episodic towards the beginning and then escalate the tension of the through line later and have it become less episodic as you get more towards the end, and then use that through line to kind of pick it up.
This is also a good way to use a character's emotional growth as a through line. For example, if you wanted a story where the arc was the main character like learning to care about this new town that they've moved to, you could start some kind of political problem, local politics. Like, well, I just moved to this town and now someone wants to install a waste dump next to my kid's playground. And that's something I gotta stop. And, you know, this gets them involved with like the local community groups, and this gets them some friends. And then it's something they had to do in the short term that will give them some longer term emotional connection. And then in like the next episode, the town gets like attacked by corporate bandits.
Corporate bandits.
Yeah, I mean, they're mad because that you wouldn't let them build their toxic waste dump there or whatever. And then, you know, now and then you get like, I don't know, some kind of cool sci-fi gun or whatever. And then in the last episode, like, the CEO of the evil corporate bandits is running to be mayor of the town, so you have to run to be mayor of the town to beat them. And, like, now look, you have decided you care about this town that you live in. And, you know, that's like, you've completed your emotional arc. I think that's a useful thing for authors who care a lot about their character's emotional state and really want to develop it and aren't so into a continuous, like, you know, conflict-driven through line. This is a good format for that.
Yeah, I think the main thing about that is, first of all, you do have to make sure that the character's problem really stands out. Since it's the through line, we have to be very clear about what that is. And then once again, figuring out the logistics of how the episodes build on that so that we feel like they are part of that internal arc.
Yeah, that's true.
I think definitely think some things about that would be a little tricky. Totally doable, but a little tricky.
All right, shall we talk about the other kind of episodic prose story, which is like a series of shorter stories published in a series?
Sure.
Because, you know, that's basically Murderbot, and Murderbot's very good. So I guess all stories of that format must be good. That's my new theory.
Well, Murderbot is also a example of the internal arc of the character being what kind of binds those books together. I mean, there are some external plot points that appear multiple times, but it really does feel like the character progression is what holds those stories together in that case. But those very much stand alone, right, as separate books. Whereas usually when we're looking at an episodic novel, we want something that's bound together a little bit more tightly than the series of Murderbot novellas.
Yeah, that's true. It would feel a little weird if all of the Murderbot novellas were published as a single book.
It doesn't have an escalation towards a climax for all four of them. And, you know, it's more episodic than even an episodic novel would normally be.
It's fascinating just like how it ends up getting distributed affects this. The issue that we're faced with, are there really, besides like Dawn Treader, like good examples of an episodic novel? Because it's all bound into just like one book. And then the preferred medium for this kind of storytelling is visual. It's just dominated by that. I just am musing on the expectation of holding something in your hand and expecting it to be a complete story. Unless it's a comic book, you know, or like a comic book or a graphic novel that's part of a series. Like that's episodic. Think of like Sandman or something like that.
Yeah, the expectations that we have for comics are similar to other visual mediums like TV shows.
Yeah, very much.
I mean, I would say it's worse with comics because, like, with comics, if you buy them, like, as they come out, very often what you get is significantly less story than an episode of TV.
Oh, yeah.
It's more like you just bought the first act of an episode of TV, which is one reason I don't read comics. It's because it's really hard to keep track of them and, like, which issue I need to buy and when it's available and, like, should I get them as they come out or wait until they're all done?
Wait until they're bound into volumes, because a lot of times it feels like that episode is at the volume level.
I just really am glad to see more stories using the novella series format. I think that's an underutilized format for prose fiction. It allows you to tell a story that isn't enough to fill an entire novel. Like, it's just not big enough for a novel, but it's still a cool story, and, like, I'd like to read about it, and it benefits from being in prose form.
And some writers do a lot better with plotting when they're doing something shorter, because they don't have as much room to, like, futz around and go on side quests and do other things that really shouldn't be in there.
Rude of you to call out the first Murderbot novel like that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, that is kind of what happened. Although it's not exactly the part of the issue is simply that it really felt like the problem that they were dealing with in the first novel of the Murderbot series should have been bigger than the ones they were dealing with in the novellas. But it was basically the same problem, which was like, you know, will Murderbot and its humans survive? And that's always been the problem we were dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, we could do a whole conversation about the Murderbot novel. But I think of novella as like movie length.
I think novella is like an underappreciated length, you know, and I hope that like more, if people pursue this, it affords you just so much more room to, I think more room to express like a complete thing without getting bloated. But there, I don't know if there's like pressure to get like that 300 page mark for your novel or something, or like, ah, this short story is too long. You know, like it's definitely a tightrope you got to walk.
Well, I mean, the publishing industry definitely prefers novels.
Yeah, they do.
There's not a lot of money to be had in short stories, even less than there is in novels. And they just don't have the same cultural impact, right? Like, that's one of the reasons why I don't critique short stories that much on the website. It's just because, like, it's very unlikely anyone will have heard of them, right? It's like, here, this short story, I'm going to talk about it. And people will be like, Oren, what do you mean? Whereas if I use a novel, there's a reasonable chance people will have at least heard of it, if not actually read it.
Yeah, that's fortunately true. But I think one of the interesting things about series of whatever the level is, a novella or a novel, what have you, is that the expectations that we were talking about are just wide open. It could be anything. They could be entirely separate stories to basically the same story, just chopped up. Now, that's not very fun. I think that each book in a series should have its own arc to some degree, but you could get anything.
What if we just, like, took every Discworld book and made a mega bind, like, thing? Would that be the ultimate episodic novel?
I don't think my bookshelf is big enough.
No, I don't think anyone's is.
But, I mean, the episodic novella series has the sort of the same feeling as a TV show in that, like, you know, I want to put on an episode of Murderbot and just watch Murderbot for a while. And it, you know, allows you to get, I would say, more character focus. Because you still need a plot, right? You still need conflict and turning point and resolution. But when it's over a series of separate installments, the main character can be the thing that keeps you watching. And, you know, you can just get the same feeling of like, yeah, you know, I'm putting on an episode of TNG because I want to watch the bridge crew, like, mess around. And it's like, I'll put on an episode of Murderbot because I want to see Murderbot do something.
That's why it's aggravating when people switch up the main character between a series.
Yeah.
It's really demotivating. I do often wish, like, look, if you want to, like, write another story where your side character is the main character, you know, that's totally fine, but making it part of the same series arc is kind of mean, right? Like, they can have their own story and their own arc that people can read separately that's in the same world. But when you switch it up for the same plot arc, the series through line, then if people want to continue the arc, they have to leave behind the character that they grew attached to. This is exactly my issue with Gideon the Ninth, right? Where it's like, no, I don't want to read about Harrow. I didn't even like Harrow, right? Didn't even succeed. Like, besides the fact that she's a side character, to me, she wasn't even likable. So no, I'm not going to continue the series, even though I enjoyed Gideon the Ninth and was also frustrated with Gideon the Ninth, but I still enjoyed Gideon the Ninth.
Gideon especially was a weird choice because it's so character focused. Yeah, theoretically, there's a plot with the Empire, but does anyone care? Like, seriously, is anyone reading this being like, oh, yeah, well, I definitely care about that Empire thing. It's like, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it's Gideon that everyone cares about. Now, like, certainly I think some people have transferred their care of Gideon to Harrow because, like, they were really into that romance. And they're like, well, now we want Harrow back. And also Gideon's body got stolen. So that, like, kind of implies she's going to be resurrected, which I would, you know, it's just irritating. Don't kill characters if you're just going to bring them back. But, like, I think that's also a thing that people are kind of counting on. We'll see. Then we can have Gideon the Ninth 2, Electric Boogaloo. Finally, the where's one last thing I want to talk about, which is not exactly the same, but it's related. And this is the anthology story. And this is, like, a story that has something in common. It can be the main character. It can be the setting where, like, whatever that thing is the main draw. They're interesting. Like, Sherlock Holmes is an anthology story. Like, very few of the Sherlock Holmes stories are connected in any way, and there isn't really a character arc that Sherlock Holmes is going through the way we have with Murderbot. So you can read most of those stories in, like, any order. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, too, just when you do read, like, the collections when they're put, like, when he published them, that eventually when you get to the final problem, which isn't really that many stories in, that he's like, okay, I need to kill Sherlock Holmes because he's boring. And then everybody's like, no, how dare you? Bring him back. And he's like, well, I do have a fierce gambling addiction, so I might as well publish a few more stories. But then it got kind of wild when he got through his Holmes phase and then started doing those Challenger stories, because that started with a novel. I think it was Lost World. And then, you know, where they go into the Amazon and discover dinosaurs, or I don't know, things happened. But then Professor Challenger, in, like, the other stories, there was a novella and, like, a couple short stories, and the short stories are just weird. Like, Oren has a critique on, this is an old one, and, like, a machine that they go, like, investigate because the Russians working on it or something like
that. I hate that story. Oh my god, it's so bad.
It's terrible. I don't even want to talk about it anymore. There's another story where they just, where he has, like, a theory that the Earth is actually a sea urchin. So he digs a hole in England and he, like, makes the Earth, like, respond. I don't know, by, like, poking it.
Yeah, sure. That may as well happen.
Sounds like a sea urchin on the beach. Poke it with a stick.
Oh, there's another one where, like, everyone on the planet dies for a little bit except them, because he figured out the Earth was going to move through some cosmic gas cloud. It's like, but anyway, I'm saying this because then the novella, which I think he wrote before he did those other weird stories, confronts ghosts and, like, the afterlife, and it pushes Challenger to, like, have, like, this like a come to Jesus kind of moment of, like, self-actualization that apparently he just, like, threw out the window and wrote a few more, like, stories. But it just, like, defeats the purpose if you're gonna do, like, a series of stories connected by a character that the writer or maybe the readers find interesting, and, like, you have the growth happen, but then you write more stories that don't address that in any way.
That's like, you have character growth and then we, like, reset it at the end, right? That's, you know, that's your Voyager problem, where it's like, oh, a lot of stuff happens, and then, like, oops, at the end of the episode we press the reset button and everything's back to the way it was.
Yeah, you're like, producers, like, okay, you need to do this again, and we like it better when the main character was just, like, meaner and less relatable, so why don't you bring that back?
All right, well, I think that will go ahead and round out this episode. Those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can leave a comment on the website at mythgrants.com. Before we go, I want to thank a few of our patrons. First, we have Kathy Ferguson, who's a professor of political theory in Star Trek. Next, we have Amon Jobber. He's a fantasy writer and a connoisseur of Marvel. And finally, we have Danita Rambo. She lives at therambogeeks.com. We'll talk to you next week.
If this episode resonated with you, post a review on iTunes to increase the range of our spells. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. Accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.